Black Type Thoroughbreds is a new thoroughbred racing partnership that gives you the chance to get in the game. Not many of us have the money to buy our own professional sports franchise, but you can have a somewhat similar experience in the world of thoroughbred racing with a partnership like Black Type. Black Type's deep connections in the industry mean you're going to get top-level access to the best horsemen and horses. It's a great way to get involved. People are always asking me what they can do to learn more about ownership. Being involved in a partnership like Black Type that has a low markup and great people involved like Jake Ballas is the best way, I can tell you, to get involved as a thoroughbred owner. For more information, you can reach out to Jake directly and check out the information on his website. That web address is blacktypetb.com. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show 97. That's an amazing number. And, you know, we've done a bunch this year that didn't get numbered, which really means we're already over this big number. And it's not just a big number for the 100 shows we've done this year, but if you go back to the entire history of this show, place with the letters and all that, that means we are approaching slash have already passed, I believe it would be our 500th episode, starting back in, gosh, when was it? October or November of 2014 in the shadow of the Chrysler building, now in the Brooklyn bunker. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, in that very Brooklyn bunker, and we have a kind of different show today. Going to start off bringing in the usual co-host, and we're going to do our thing for a bit, but then we're going to turn things over to our correspondent, Naomi Tucker, who has a really interesting sit-down with Jason Service, and you're going to want to stick around and hear what they have to say. That'll be at the end of the show, but for the beginning, we're going to bring him in. He's back from Arizona, back in the planet Texas. The people's champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, how are you?
BTF, I'm driving, so you have to forgive the audio, but I missed you so much that I had no choice but to do whatever it took to spend some time with you this morning.
That is a very nice Christmas sentiment. We've got a lot of Christmas material. Not a lot. We're going to have some Christmas material coming up on the show. We should put this out there because it's already the 13th of December. Production meeting in the middle of the show. Now, if there's somebody out there, some challenger to Gene Menez's throne of having the most knowledge about the history of this podcast, Gene, of course, won the Christmas quiz we did last year, the holiday quiz that we did last year. We're going to do one again. And, you know, there has been a challenge. It wasn't from second place finisher Matt Scarlatta, but it was from one of his crazy friends who insisted that it was unfair. He had some sort of technicality. He suggested an inquiry to go back and potentially change the result of last year's quiz. Not going to do that, but we could just run a rematch between those two. But if you're a listener out there who thinks you deserve to be part of this holiday quiz. Last year, we did have three people. We're not going to let Drew Cotney back in because now, you know, he's on the team, so that wouldn't be fair. But if there's somebody out there who wants to participate, let us know. You can hit us up over at the podcast website, inthemoneypodcast.com. But what do you think, JK, about that idea of just running the rematch and letting those two battle it out again?
Yeah, I like the idea of having a rematch and then adding that a third person again. So we'll take one more newcomer in to kind of see if there's any new blood. But
I like it.
Yeah, I think maybe the original two and then the third person.
Okay, so that's an open spot out there. Let us know. Contact us. If you have our info, hit us up on Twitter at Looms Boldly, at UT Big Hair. But of course, you already have our Twitter handles memorized if you're good enough to potentially stand against Gene and try to win this thing. And I'll also say this, and don't send these on Twitter. Reach out privately with these. We could use some help with questions. I have a few new questions. Obviously, they've got to be all new questions because if it's going to be the same folks as last year. But I have a bunch of avenues in my mind. I haven't written anything down. But this is one where listeners can really help. If you have any ideas for questions to throw at Matt and Gene, hit us up there. Use the contact tool over at inthemoneypodcast.com. And JK, this year I'm going to have you. You contributed a few questions last year, but are you ready to step up and come up with a bunch of them? I mean, I fired many of my best shots.
Pete, I have an education background. I'm a certified teacher here in the state of Texas. Actually, you know what? I honestly don't think I am anymore because I haven't done any of that continuing education in the last 10 years. But at one time, I was an educator here in the state. And so coming up with questions is one of my specialties.
New theories.
Not really.
I was just going to say, new theories arising about the problems with the youth in Texas dating back to your tenure as one of their educators, JK.
I wasn't really a teacher. I like to think of it more of as I was a facilitator.
I have to ask a follow-up. What are you talking about?
Can you imagine? Just close your eyes and visualize this. It's Thursday, May 2nd, and I'm in class. And what do you think I'm doing on Thursday, May 2nd, the entire day I'm in class? And I think you'll understand what I mean by teaching rather than facilitating.
Other way around, facilitating rather than teaching.
Exactly.
Well, you could have gone the Marshall Graham route and just taught a course in it. I mean, think about all the things you can teach a child when it comes to studying the form. There's math, there's science, great narratives that you could write about it. Every subject, politics, we got loads of politics. You could do an entire curriculum based on horse racing. Maybe that's what your career would have, maybe that's the direction you would have gone in had you stayed in education.
Well, they used to block the DRS, but I had a workaround. Don't worry about that. I will say this. Speaking of curriculum, it's not been like officially released yet. But you know, Marshall Graham obviously did his racetrack betting markets class. I think he's done it twice in two springs there at Rhodes College. This spring, if everything goes according to plan, he's going to be offering that course online so anyone can take it.
Phenomenal.
And, I think that's going to be really cool for some people that that are higher level, lower level, and just getting started to learn more about the game. I was actually telling Marshall he needs to reach out to all these racetrack executives and get their staff to take the class. It's kind of continuing education. I think that there's a lot of things in there they can learn from. You know, they talk about track bias. They talk about reading the tote board and understanding the markets and the wagering and ticket construction and speed figures. And it's a lot of things I think that our industry would be better off if all of the stakeholders and all of the decision makers had their level of understanding that Marshall contains. And if you just get a little piece of that from taking his class, I think it's worth it.
Marshall confided in me that the second time he ran the racetrack betting markets class went a lot better than the first did. Do you know why?
I mean, he probably told you that because he wanted something from you.
You haven't let me give the punchline to my joke yet, though.
I know what it is.
Because I was a guest instead of you.
I feel like Eminem and 8 Mile. I got right out in front of your joke and ruined it.
You really did. You really did. You got the mic drop moment on me here on show 97. But the thing, in all seriousness, when you were talking about Marshall's class, you did sound like someone who's just at an academic conference about horse racing, which of course you were. What can you share with the listeners about your experience out at Arizona?
It was really cool. I had never been before. One thing that I got to be honest, I was kind of impressed with is when I walked in, it said the 46th annual. I had no idea that this was such a long-standing symposium. You know, I mean, obviously, we've got EquestriCon and these things that are on their third, or these little one-offs that pop up, that conventions and things of that nature. And like, so the fact that this one's been around for 46 years, I was pretty impressed with. And then as I started flipping through the program, it, you know, to see some of the names and some of the people that they got to come out. I mean, they had a panel with Todd Pletcher and Bob Baffert, both alumni of the racetrack industry program there. And then to see all the kind of the young people running around that are actually going through the course and asking questions. And, you know, had a young guy come up to us. Honestly, the most productive thing I feel like I accomplished was when this young guy came up and asked, you know, I got about a couple semesters left, but what should I do? And I said, if you have time for electives, I would take programming classes. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And then I elaborated, and then Marshall jumped in and he elaborated as well. And like, if that kid takes programming classes, he's going to be significantly better off as a horse player, better, and even an executive from the things that he can do on that end of it. So, it was an inspiring situation to be at. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's times that are frustrating. Marshall and I got up and walked out of one conversation, which I won't say which one it was, but if you look through the program, you'll probably figure it out.
You say what it was? What's the problem?
Well, I, to be honest, I could care less. Michael Dickinson, when he was talking about folly, I left.
Like, did you see my tweets? Yeah, did you see my tweets about that? And then Steve Bick and I talked about it yesterday as well. You were saying. I mean, he's literally trying to sell the stuff, and so we're supposed to take these comments as objective and listen to this nonsense about how, well, dirt's had 1,000 years, and I mean, come on, it's such a logical fallacy in so many ways. And look, I'm not coming at this as somebody who's anti-synthetic in the least. I think there very well may be a role for synthetics, but I want to see them, if they do come back in any more than the role they have in the game now, I don't want it to be a headlong rush as a reaction to what's happened this year. I want it to be something that's scientifically tested and done in a sensible manner, and just somebody making these anecdotal arguments and then to back up the point, I'll bring up a trainer who happens to excel on the surface and I'm supposed to be convinced by that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I was at the bar when that happened. But the idea that, like, it just is anything, horse racing aside, if I, and I'm just driving down the road right now, so I'm going to just make up the best example I can. If I go to a conference about pancakes, and there's a guy up there from IHOP telling me why Denny's is the worst pancake place in the world, and, like, it's hard for me to take the guy from IHOP seriously, right? It's like you clearly have a vested interest in your angle. And then when you put the reasons on the board and it's like a list of 10 things that are kind of all saying the same thing, and none of them are research based or fact based, or they're just all kind of like, you know, one of the lines he said was like, the speed that thrills is the speed that kills. Like, stop it. Like, come on. You know, how about some numbers? How about some real numbers? And I know the numbers support that synthetic is more of a safe surface. I understand that. I also think that, you know, there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more to it. You know, Marshall's made some great points about, no one's said, is there more fatalities in sprints than routes?
Right.
We know the answer to that question. I've never seen the number.
Never seen. I don't know that it's ever been. I don't know that it's been studied, though. I think there's so much data that could be looked at to approach this in a more holistic and sensible way. And, you know, numbers are they're a funny thing, and they can be looked at in a lot of different ways. And it's, you know, this, yes, that it is a striking number of differences in fatalities when you look at the deaths per thousand stat, and the synthetic numbers come out better. And they might even be better than they look on the surface, given the quality of racing happening on the two surfaces. I get that. But it's also true that 99.83% of races, or something very close to that, go off without any of these kind of problems. And even in a synthetic world where we reduce the number, maybe that goes up to 99.9%. And that's better, but I don't know. There's another way of looking at the world where I don't know that it moves the needle that much, especially not when it comes to our harshest critics. Now, I'm sympathetic to the point that we want to do everything within our power to make racing safer. And again, that's why I'm interested in a smart way of maybe rolling out some more synthetic tracks and maybe in some bigger circuits or places where it might make sense, like California. But the headlong rush to do so, to me, is a big mistake. And from what I was seeing, and I didn't hear the whole presentation, but from what I was following on Twitter and my conversation with Steve, there was some real propaganda happening out there that in that particular conference. But it sounds like on the whole, JK, it was a very positive experience. What's another panel that you saw that you really enjoyed?
Yeah, I was going to do that if you didn't invite me to kind of focus on the good stuff. So even when I was coaching, we would go to these coaching conventions. I think a lot of people, conventions can be interesting, right? It's like a whole lot of wasted time, a whole lot of BS, a whole lot of whatever. But the networking is second to none, to just to meet people that you can try to do some fun, creative ideas with. And then also, if you can just get like little pieces to kind of help you in any way, I think it's great. And one of the things, some of the things that I really picked up that I loved was, is Mattress Mack spoke. And one of the things that he said that I thought was 100% true, and we've talked about it, I just never said it in such a concise sentence, is that it's problematic to me that so many lawyers and accountants are higher level executives that are making decisions in our game. And for obvious reasons, lawyers obviously are risk averse. They're not trying to rock any boats. Lawyers' first answers about doing things are always typically no, because they are continuously thinking about the legal ramifications of those decisions. And then conversely, you know, the accountants are counting pennies. So when you know, most ideas cost money, and accountants don't like to do those. They don't like to spend money. So I think that there's something to be said about that. We don't have a lot of marketing types that are making decisions. I mean, obviously, and I'm partial to this person, but like Tony Alivato, I guess, would be a great example of someone who is a marketing guy who's a higher up that's making decisions and doing things that are innovative. But you know, not every entity has someone like that at a high level making decisions. So that was one thing that I got from Mac that I thought was really good. Innovate or evaporate was a phrase he continued to state that I thought was good. Our own Pat Cummings, who I was on the panel with, he said he made a comparison to this cheap idea that racing has, that if we can somehow get on the same shelf as sports betting, and he was comparing it to fresh bread and stale bread, that we can maybe trick some customers into picking up the stale bread, which obviously we are. And I don't think, you know, it sounds like it's a disparaging comment, but in all honesty, it's true. I mean, we're priced higher. Our data is more expensive, and our game is more complicated, and we anti-market ourselves in a lot of different ways. So it's not like it's some self-deprecating statement that's like, you know, I mean, we really are, you know, stale bread. So that was an interesting thing that I thought. What else?
Did you go to the Baffert-Pletcher one? I'm curious to hear more about that. I was very surprised that they both came out in favor of the elimination of race day Lasix. I guess that was the headline from the piece. What else did you hear in that session?
Well, yeah, so that was shocking. That was more, Todd was more, in my opinion, this is my stance. I've completely, fully formed this stance based on, you know, a lot of time, a lot of thinking, and a lot of thought. Baffert's kind of lean was more to like, I don't give a damn. I'm just tired of talking about it. And if it's somehow going to get people to leave us alone, and people and the decision makers in our industry believe that's the case, then like, so be it. Like, I'm tired of hearing about it.
Sounded resigned. Resigned almost.
Yeah. And he said he's never given a horse 10 cc's. I'm very clear that he said that. But I think he said he gives all of his like 3.5. I'm not saying he's never given a horse more than 3.5, but he says he only gives 3.5, so he's not really concerned. And he didn't know other people gave close to 10, until this conversation started, when people started getting angry at him for being a part of agreeing to drop it to 5. So, and they were just telling good stories, fun stories. I mean, those two guys, it's very clear very quickly why they're as successful as they are. They're obviously talented horsemen and talented horse trainers, but they're obviously great businessmen and great ambassadors for the game, whether it's from an intellectual standpoint or just a pure entertainment standpoint, right? So that was fun to watch those two guys. Listen, I sat in. A lot of this stuff was over my head, but I listened to Jeff Canizzo and some of the other regional breeding directors talking about their programs and how the state breds are so valuable to the game, and how they really help with the foal population and so on and so forth. So that was just some interesting knowledge to pick up. And then trying to think what else we did. I mean, and then just honestly, like hanging out with Pat and Marshall. I mean, those guys are so smart, and you know, I feel like I understand what's going on, and I pay attention and I care. But those guys have a depth of you know, stats that really can kind of back up some of these ideas that just kind of come natural to a majority of horse, like, you know, horse players like ourselves, but they've kind of got some of the more information to back it up. So it was good. I enjoyed it. I had a great time just talking to some of these people and getting to know some other people in the industry that are trying to make some adjustments here.
We'll have to talk to them about doing some sort of audio version next year. I mean, it seems like if they wanted to stream it live, that would have already happened. But I was just envisioning a world in which you get all those things recorded and then cut them into something after the fact that then becomes like a de facto commercial for the next year. I wonder if they wouldn't be interested in something like that, and they could be released as podcasts or sent out on demand, or there could be, I wonder if they'd be open to that. I would imagine there'd be a lot of stuff that we could go back to and listen to when you're talking about, you know, smart people talking about these key areas. And obviously, look, you don't have to agree with what's being said, but just anytime you can hear these type of ideas exchanged, I figure you got to be able to learn something going back in retrospect. Would you agree? Would it be picturing the sessions you saw? Do you think there'd be a market if folks could go back and maybe listen to edited versions of them?
For sure. I guess the biggest issue would be is I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's pretty expensive. I mean, I think it's like $500, $600 a person. So I guess my concern is how much does the university and that program depend on that money?
Well, I think this would make them more money. I'm not talking about giving away everything. You'd do, you know, edited versions that would become a commercial for the next year. So the next year you'd get that many more people wanting to go and see it all and be a part of it all.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, in high school, I never read a book. I just read the cliff notes, right? So it's like my concern is that I guess my concern if I was there would be is by providing this, do we somehow de-incentivize people from coming?
I mean, I think it's the exact opposite, personally. I mean, I think you incentivize people to want to go. I mean, when you're going to a conference, at least half of what you're getting out of the conference is being there and networking. And by that same logic, then why have people write articles about what was – said in the thing, because you're giving away. I think there's a smart way to do it, you know, and maybe an hour show and you put 15 minutes of it on there. It would be shocking to me if it didn't increase participation, but it's also a lot of work and I'd need to get paid for it, frankly. So I'm not volunteering anything here. I think it would be a smart business move for them though. And now that we're in good with folks there, we'll perhaps raise it. All right. Enough about the conference. But I do want to start our Ask ITM questions for this show by asking you a follow-up about the kid you talked to and you told him to take some programming classes. I would imagine there are some people in the audience who don't exactly know what benefit that would be to a horse player. So JK, why don't you explain?
Well, I mean, I think from a broader stroke, anything that you try to accomplish in racing, you know, Pete and I have tried to do lots of different things, initiatives, whether sitting on the Breeders' Cup wagering committee board, hey, why don't we try this? Or, hey, it'd be cool if we had this wager. Or what if we did this? Or what if we do that? And, you know, when we were at DRF, helping with DRF tournaments, hey, why don't you guys do this? Every answer to every good idea in racing is usually, oh, but we don't have the tech for that. Oh, yeah, but the tech. Yeah, but, you know, I think it's a tote issue. Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if the tote can handle that. Yeah, you know, that's cool. It's just going to be really expensive to change that on the website. We're not sure it's going to move the needle.
Yep.
Everything comes back to, like, it's a tech thing. And so I've always felt, and I'm not the only one, it's not like I'm just an original thought, that if these young people who understand the game have a better edge when it comes to programming and understanding how things can be done, they can speak the language to a programming, like actual programming firm, or they can do it on their own. Those are all things that will be beneficial in trying to get some of these things changed. I mean, we're behind the times in terms of technology. It's very clear. I mean, I've been watching NFL games and college football games and college basketball games in HD for 5-10 years. I mean, I can watch Portland State play, you know, who cares you tonight, and it'll be in HD on my computer I mean, I can't watch Delta Downs in HD. And so, like, we're just behind. And so I think that's one thing that could help for if you're looking for a job in this industry is to have a nice background and understanding for programming. I mean, I gave the same advice to Carson Matisse, who's started college. And obviously, he's going to have the pedigree and the base knowledge of horseplay that takes some people a lifetime to gather. Imagine that with a programming degree. Obviously, there's a lot of powerful things you can do with that. And you know, and then Marshall, like, you know, hanging out with Marshall, he helps clean up your thoughts. The idea that we have more data available to us in the current landscape of the world, and no one knows how or what to do with it. And I think that, like, being able to sort and
elegantly process data, setting up queries to try to answer some of these questions, whether we're talking about the issue of equine fatality like we were before, or even concerns more germane to the everyday horse player. I mean, the ability to process data and look at questions with data. I mean, analytics are everywhere in sports and business, and I think it's fair to say that we're a bit behind in horse racing when it comes to using analytics properly to evaluate ourselves and improve ourselves as an industry. So that would be another avenue. And then, you know, very simply, just as horse players, I feel like whether it's trying to create tools to help you wager or process the data that you're using in handicapping, it just feels to me like it'd be a pretty good club to have in the bag.
Yeah, so I think that's... I mean, I've even thought about doing it, and then my stomach starts hurting thinking about signing up for any type of course. Yeah, I mean, I've thought about going back. And
you know, there is math involved, JK.
That's what I'm saying. Anybody have time for that? Even though Pat Cummings did say, I don't remember, we were at dinner with her, and say he said that he learned algebra. He learned algebra at the racetrack. That was the first time he grasped it, when he was trying to figure out why a 4-to-1 shot paid $10.
I'm telling you, we said it before, there isn't a topic out there that you couldn't, that your understanding couldn't be deepened by handicapping and betting on horse races. Everything I needed to know in life, I learned by watching the Kentucky Derby. Perhaps that's a future book title for me, JK. What do you think?
That'd be good. We could sell it, so if so you put it in people's, like, little bags, they get it freshman orientation.
All right, we got a couple of other questions I want to get to before we get to our guest interview today. Here's one that came across the transom from Josh. When betting to win, JK, how do you go about estimating the fair value odds for a favorite?
Yeah, you know, that we just did, like, a whole 20 minutes on JK tries, math fails. So here's the thing, right? When it comes to that, is it's more, I don't bet the win very much. If I love a horse in a sequence, serial complainers, put down your keyboard. When I love a horse in a sequence, I 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1, 12-to-1 is not good enough for me. I want to turn the 3-to-1 into 12-to-1, the 12-to-1 into 50-to-1. The 20-to-1 and 100-to-1, and I want to turn it into that with efficiently playing the races surrounding that opinion in a format where I'm only taken out one time. And if I can do that in a pick five where the takeout is low and there's a lot of dead money, then I want to do that. So that's the long answer. Is I don't really bet to win that much. So there's that. The other part is, I've done it before where I have a tab that I've, or a bookmark I've saved of this win odds chart where, like, if you look at the odds, if you, it'll tell you the percentage chance that horse has to win, what the odds are suggesting. So what I would do when I first started, and I used to do it a lot, now I think maybe just happens in my brain a little bit without being able to explain it, is I'll go through the horses and I'll put the chances that I feel like they have to win. And I just saw, just, you know, I'll, American Pharoah will win this race 60% of the time, and then 30%, 40%, 20%. Okay, that's too much. Let me take 10 here. Okay, let me take 5 there. Well, I can't have him at 5 and him at 5 because that doesn't make any sense. Let me drop him to 2, him to 10. And I do that until I get to 100 or even 110 because of the line and the takeout and all that stuff.
You shouldn't do it over 100. You're not trying to beat the takeout in your wager. You're trying to win. So that's a mistake right there, Matt. There's a JK tries math fails right there.
Exactly. So I don't do it that much. But that's kind of what I'll do is that's what I've done in the past, and that can kind of help you find some things. But I also think that, like, if you're not playing every day and looking at every race, that the idea that every play you make has to be a positive EV play is not accurate.
Expand on
because that. Well, because first of all, if you wake up on a Saturday, you work hard Monday through Friday, you want to have some fun, you get away for a little bit, you know, you're hanging out with friends and family or whatever, you want to play some races, it could be a miserable experience if you're only making wagers with a positive EV, because they don't come up that much. So you don't want to just show up and take a 30-1 shot because he's 30-1 and you come up with a thing that says he should be 112-1 or whatever. So it's like, oh, now I have to bet the source because of that. You want to just try to have a basic understanding of value and go from there. I don't think you have to master value. And in my opinion, value can kind of be manufactured with different pool types as well, right? Like, you could make it work and by playing doubles and playing exactives and playing tries and playing pick fours and you know, things like that. So I think that old school way of looking at it is just that. It's an old school way, and I think there's probably some more angles and avenues in this day and age.
You've said some very controversial things. I mean, I can hear several people on Twitter already, and even I to some degree, chiming in with the idea that whatever bet you're making, just changing the pool does not change the fact that you need to be making bets that have a positive expectation. Now, maybe what you're saying is that you believe in your construction of the bets in those other pools, you can get some of the value back that way that might not be in the selections you're making.
What I'm saying is, if you're playing if you're looking at a race, and you feel like you're trying to decide if you want to make a wager on Sharp Azteca. You think fair odds for Sharp Azteca is even money in this race, but he's clicking back and forth between 3-5 and 4-5. And maybe I'm wrong, so this could be therapy. I don't know. This is what I do. So if I see this horse is 3-5 or 4-5, but God, that feels kind of short. But a horse like Whitmore is in the race. It's a one-turn mile race. I don't think Whitmore wants to go a mile. Whitmore is 3-1. That seems a little bit short. Now, in my brain, the value is hitting an exacto with Whitmore out and Sharp Azteca on top. Then I feel like I'm almost guaranteed to have that value that I was on the fence about in the win pool.
That does make sense. I don't think that's wrong. You're finding value in – I was thinking – about horizontal pools, you're using a vertical example that makes that make sense. I'll just go back. There's a lot of stuff there, and you could do a whole show on it, and I don't want to go too down that rabbit hole right now because we only have a few minutes left, but I'll just answer the original question in very much the same way. I would try to build a spreadsheet. And in fact, there's one on my old blog. I think there might even be one on, I don't know if we've ever posted it on the In the Money podcast blog, but if you're interested in this, reach out to me and I'll get you a spreadsheet. But there are spreadsheets that will basically do that for you, where you can plug in the number of times out of 100 that you think the horse is going to win, and you'll have a line generated for you. And then you could bet the horses that are, you figure out what price you think the favorite should be that way, and then make your betting decision from there. I do believe that after a while, you do start to do that by feel. But even now, I'd be much more confident betting a race if I took the time to make the 100% odds line. And if you're a novice player, if you're just learning, I really can't recommend it enough. I think it's a great thing for everybody to do, to really think about the way that math and probability are entwined. And it'll make you a better horse player if you're starting out to play around with that. I know Spencer on Red Board Rewind at some point wants to do a whole episode about value lines. He suggested bringing in Matt Bernier maybe as a guest, which would be great. I know Matt is very reliable at doing those. Roxy Roxborough often for big races will put his 100% value line out on his Twitter account. Mark Kramer in his books goes over that process in great depth. And I know back in the day in my old blog when I was doing the 100% lines, that's how I do it all the time. And, you know, frankly, I should do it more now for the big races at least. But, of course, life gets in the way. And feel is a funny thing. Rob Dove, one of the top 10 pro punters in the UK today, had the best line, as far as I'm concerned, ever about feel, which is that it's responsible for all the best and all the worst bets. and talking about how it can be misused. I do think at the top levels, we do sometimes have that intuition that can guide us in a fortunate way. But especially when you're starting out, I caution against using feel because I just feel like it leads you. It can be an excuse to be lazy, I guess. What would you say to that, JK? How much of your wagering do you feel is based on feel?
My decision making is made on feel. The horseplay, the handicapping and construction is slightly more like fact driven. You know what I mean?
Certainly the handicapping is.
Yeah. You know what I will say though is this is the other thing. The other thing that I do, and I think a lot of other people do, like, you know, Marshall included, is to avoid having to overthink value. I find pools that do that for me. I'm at this like horse play where I'm only playing contests, carryovers, big days. That's it. I won't make any wagers except for the Stronach 5 because I like a dollar minimum. I think that hurts the computer players from being able to be as efficient. I also don't think the computer players are playing in that pool very much. Because if you look, this is another great thing about hanging out with Marshall Graham. He's kept an eye on it and notices that last flash, you're not seeing the influx of money like you do in all the other pools, which would indicate that the computers are not participating in that pool. So that's one way that I don't have to really overthink the whole thing about, well, this horse is 6-5, but do I need him to be, 2-1 to play, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to really do that because I'm playing in a pool that essentially has no takeout. And if you can play in a pool with no takeout.
Why do you say it has no takeout?
Well, not this one, but I'm saying not the Stronach 5 today, but okay. Carryover. Carryovers are, you look at Marshall's Twitter.
I would say reduced. Yeah, I mean, that's true. A lot of those jackpot ones that Marshall highlights do have can be a positive expectation, but in many cases, it's just greatly reduced. But I mean,
with the jackpot, so this is like a whole other conversation. But jackpot mandatory payout days are kind of something that I think we're all still trying to wrap our brains around because the payouts always seem low. It just never seems to be what everyone hopes and thinks it's going to be.
Wasn't bad the other day.
Well, no, that wasn't bad. That wasn't bad on that mandatory day, but
many of them have been. Yeah,
many of them have been. But my point is that. The random ones, the $24,000 carryover at Indiana Grand or whatever, those typically come back with a player's edge.
Yes.
So often you'll see there's actually an edge to the player. So that kind of helps, But also I have the luxury of not having to do what some of these other guys do where they're grinding and playing every day because that's what they're doing for their living. And, you can't wait for carryovers. When you have to pay the mortgage and feed the kids.
No doubt about it. It's a very different game when you're playing every day and when you're playing for a living, other than it being part of a big portfolio of things that you and I attempt to do for money. And it puts us in a much more favorable position to mess around more and not have to worry as much about EV and then to concentrate a lot of our resources to invest on the big carryover days like we had last weekend at NYRA with the mandatory payout.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I also think when it comes to this value question, when I'm looking at a sequence and there's a race where I'm going to single, and I know that 75% of other people are using more than one horse in that race, the value question to me is answered at that moment. Like, there, it's a 15% takeout bet anyways in a pick five sequence or whatever, depending on where you're at. And then I'm singling in a leg where everyone else is using two or three horses or savers or whatever, and I'm ice cold, then my value question is over. I'm home and hosed down from a value standpoint at that point, and now I just got to try to hit it a couple times and have it for $3 or $4 or $10 or $12, you know?
There's so much to go on about this. We probably have to do a whole show just about this question. Maybe we'll have time this winter and we can bring in some other guests. I'd like to hear what a lot of people have to say. I know a lot of pro players are going to have a lot of issue with stuff that you threw in there. And it'll be a fun conversation for another time. I do agree with most of what you're saying, but I think there's some nuances where we're different, but probably not quite interesting enough to go down the rabbit hole here. We'll save the topic for another time. I think we're just about ready to get out of here for the day, JK. Any closing thoughts from you on this show?
No, and my closing thought and my disclaimer is that is what works for me, and I'm fully aware that playing every day for a living, that situation would have to be different.
Okay, good. Good clarification, I think. All right, with that all said, we're going to bring in Naomi Tucker.
Trainer of multiple Grade 1 winning horses, having his most successful year to date, winning at an astonishing 30% clip and earning well over $10 million in prize money, known to the greater public as the trainer of the incredibly talented Maximum Security, Jason Service. Jason, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Inner Money Players podcast. How are you doing?
Better after the weekend, got through that. So.
Before we get into the incredible year that you've had, I wanted to go back to the beginning. I found a very interesting tale about a horse named Mr. Spaceman.
That was my brother's horse. It's been so long ago. Yeah, it was our first horse. My brother and I went half, $500 a piece. I think he might have won at Charleston. He might have won him back then. It was Waterford Park, now Mountaineer Park. That was in maybe 1971 or 72. We were still in school, high school.
You grew up around racing in Charleston, am I correct?
Yeah, my dad was a steward there.
Right.
He was with the Jockey Guild for 15 years, and then he went in the steward thing.
Would you say that you had any ambitions at the time following his footsteps in terms of becoming a jockey?
Yes, I rode for a short time. I want to say just under a year. I had a weight problem, so I quit riding and ended up in the jockey's room as a jockey dialer.
Did you work with any notable jockeys?
Oh, yeah. I had a very good corner. Pretty much gone. I worked for Bill Shoemaker when he came to Monmouth Park or Meadowlands to ride.
Wow.
I had Julie Crone in New Jersey for, I want to say, 8 or 9 years before she left for New York. I had Abar Cole when he was leading rider in Monmouth 2 years when Bobo got hurt. I had Wesley Ward stack. He was leading rider of Meadowlands and Belmont. Only one I know to ever do that. Same time. You know, I've had a lot of good riders. David Ashcroft, Joe Rocco Sr., Cornelio Velasquez. I always had a really good corner in it. You know, those guys would help you if there was a hot bug boy in Florida. I just had to let one of my jockeys know. They'd grab him for me and come up with a meet or whatever, I'd have him.
You mentioned the incredible jockeys that you looked after. How has that taught you in terms of horsemanship, and how did that shape you as a trainer later on in your career?
I think it helped them more than people would think. I mean, also, I exercised horses in the morning, and then I would work in the jockey's room. I also was an assistant trainer for 10 years and still worked the jockey's room. Probably if an owner wanted to tell me about a jockey or who to ride or watching a race, there's nobody that I would say would be more qualified than me, because I worked in the room for 22 years. Saw a lot in there. I saw a lot. I could tell if a jock was having a bad day as a trainer. I could tell if a jock was off for 10 days and took a break. I'd call his agent. I said, did he take a vacation in between meets or something? Oh, yeah, he went away. I'd see it in his riding, whoever it was. All that stuff, maybe had an argument with his wife. I'd pick it up right away. Those guys, like, the younger riders, Nick Juarez, they're all good riders, but it can't get much by me when it comes to riding or jockey's room.
That must make for a really interesting, mutual, beneficial relationship with the jockeys that you employ nowadays.
Yeah, I have a good time with them, actually. Sometimes I'll bust on them and say, what the heck are you doing at the 3/8 pole? And say, geez, my hand got stuck in the mane. How did you see that? Nobody said anything to me. But, you know, I see all that.
You mentioned you were an exercise rider yourself as well. Did you do any riding out with your own horses when you later on started training?
Absolutely. I used to get on all my own horses. I got a little too big. I needed to be able to keep a handle on things, watch everything, as opposed to if I'm exercising a horse. Let's say I had three riders out in that set. I can't see them if I'm going around on a horse, so I had to ease off galloping.
Would you sometimes still get on one if you are trying to figure something out about the horse?
I'm 62, and I don't think I've been on a horse for probably 3 or 4 years. So I think my exercise days are over.
But it must be great to have that experience on your side. And do you get the chance to educate your own riders?
I taught all my riders. I've been with them about, I mean, they've been with me, I want to say about, I got riders doing it 8-9 years. They all wear watches. They're excellent open gallops. And I kind of enjoy getting the young kids, get them in my program where they're learning to watch. I really do enjoy that. And I got a great, great crew, great team. My riders are a little different than most people. You know, I just can't hire any rider. You got to get in my program and learn how to use the watch.
Yeah, you mentioned the watch and the time and the open gallops. What I've learned about you is that you work your horses a tad bit slower than seems custom in the USA. Where does that stem from? And am I correct in saying that?
No, I don't think you are, because those horses are going an open mile, let's say a mile of 157. They're just picking them up the last 3/8. And that's what they're publishing. So hence you have a 42 work. But they're not breezing 3/8 and 42. They're going a mile and 157, galloping out a mile and an eighth and say 209, which is another 12. There's more to be read into that. That's kind of a sore subject for me. I think they should publish those open miles. I don't agree with that. There's New York wants you to have a certain amount of work. You know, and I have horses that I don't think need to work half a mile, but rather open gallop a mile of 158. I think it would be better for them. So, like I said, that's kind of a sore subject with me. You know, I had a horse win at Claiming Crown that breezed a quarter of a mile a day of the race, a horse called Mug-O-Matic. Well, they don't publish quarter miles. You know, I don't think it's fair to the public, but I don't write the rules. One day, I think that'll all get changed.
I'm very happy that you're explaining that this is a slight sore point to you, as well as explaining why you're doing it. And is there somewhere that these longer work, is that somewhere where it came from?
Yeah, you know, I kind of developed it as I was galloping my own horses, and I worked for 10 years. That the last 2 or 3 years I was with him, he got sick. So the last 2 or 3 years he didn't make it to the barn much, and I started doing my own thing, trying to keep the horses going, and I end up throwing my own watch on them. I just got into this groove, and the horses were doing good and running good, and I kind of got into this program. It's been great for me.
Well, it definitely has been paying dividends for you. As you mentioned at the beginning of our chat, your release this week is over, and it's been quite the banner year for you. You've got 160 wins under your belt and counting, and of course, your stable star, multiple Grade One winner, Maximum Security. And well, it has been a year of ups and downs, and with the season drawing to a close, how would you reflect on this year?
It's been crazy, really. I can't even put it into words, I don't think. Everything that's happened, and you know, the good stuff and the bad stuff, just not really something I expected. I didn't expect to win 3 Claiming Crown Day. Everything, Gulfstream, everything kind of fell into place. You know, Max coming along, Max being cute in the Derby. It's just been a year that I'll never forget. I don't know if I want another year like that or not. It's been a little crazy.
I hope that you can remember it, obviously, for the amazing moments. And well, I'd like to go back a little bit to when, I guess, the public got to meet Maximum Security for the first time on its winning debut at Gulfstream. But also, he had been in your barn before that. What was he like when he got to your stable?
He was a two-year-old colt that was rearing up and, you know, jumping around the stall as a handful and didn't really come around till late. He was a May 15th foal. Wasn't really showing a lot in the morning, which now that, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but I like that idea. You know, I've had some good horses that didn't do much in the morning, but were runners. Might have something to do with him, how he is.
In terms of how he sort of developed and for example, going towards that Florida Derby, what was he showing you? And was he easy to train or was he very, like you mentioned, coltish and full of himself?
You know, he was very coltish all summer. He didn't really start to settle till I got to Florida. He breezed really good at Palmettos a couple of times, and so he started to maybe come around down there.
Perhaps he started to become a little bit more of the professional thoroughbred we all know him as today. Winning at Gulfstream Park and then going into the Kentucky Derby, which was an unfortunate ending to quite the incredible race, and I'm sure you've gone over this plenty of times, but that day, what was it like for you?
Well, to be candid, it was pretty messed up. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if words can describe it, really. Sad thing is the Derby, he was the best horse that day. And they could have went around three more times. They weren't going to beat him. That's what was unfortunate about the Derby. You know, I could see him leaving him up and penalizing the jockey, whatever they wanted to do, but other than the Pegasus and the Derby, I mean, the horse, you know, goes undefeated. But that was the sad part. He was spot on that day. Another horse I blew out day of the race that had a couple slow breezes, not by design. He was, my rider was off that day a couple times. He was really nervous, and I wasn't that thrilled about going into the Derby. Two slow works for me. And I just made a decision the last minute to breeze that horse day of the race. I know the clockers did tweet something about it. The service just blew out maximum security in 23 that morning, which took a lot. You know, I mean, I'm 9-2 in the Derby, and I felt that I needed to open his lungs up and get some new blood going. And after I did it, I was really happy. The horse come off the track. He looked super. Charity there said when I left to go change, he laid down for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, which was great too, because when he got up, he was like spot on. So that was the unfortunate part, that he got disqualified that day because he was the best horse.
I'm pretty sure most people will agree with you on that account. And then I do remember that, unfortunately, he was struck by a bout of colic later on in September, mid-September, which forced him to be scratched from the Grade 1 Pennsylvania Derby. But moreover, that must have been incredibly testing for you. Would you be able to walk us through that day and night?
So I left the barn, I want to say 12:30, 1 o'clock, which is the norm for me. Everything was fine. Walked by a stall, went to my car. At 3 o'clock, my assistant called me and said, you better come check Max. I'm not happy. So I ran over, I was 10 minutes from the track, and I called on my, I told him, call Doc on, I'll meet you there. When we got there, he was in a lot of pain. I really thought he was going to have surgery because you can imagine an 1,100-pound animal throwing herself around. He was in a lot of distress, a lot of pain, and I was worried about getting him on the truck because it's hard to hold a horse, you know, when they start throwing herself around. And when he left, I thought he was destined for surgery, but Dr. Yannick at Mid-Atlantic did a sensational job. When he got there, he said he was better. I don't know if it was the ride, the bumpy ride, or what, if that thing got pushed back, you know, where it was supposed to be, but he said when he got there, he wasn't in a lot of distress. He came home the next day, to my surprise.
That was very fortunate. And how were those weeks afterwards?
Believe it or not, 4 or 5 days, he was quiet. I mean, he definitely took a toll on him. Probably one of the hardest parts about that whole thing, too, was me having to make that phone call. I mean, I was in the Pennsylvania Derby. I'm mm-hmm. favorite. And I got to call him and tell him he's going to the clinic. You know, those are tough phone calls.
Perhaps the better part of the story is that you then managed to condition him back to health to win the Grade 3 Bolt Rear at Beaumont, which was, I remember the day quite vividly. There was lots of people at the track, and I do believe they all came to see Maximum Security. How special was that for you?
That's special. It means something. When they all started cheering, that's when he wheeled and dumped Sias coming home. And that day in the Derby, I mean, there were so many people. When I was trying to walk to Max, when they were waiting to see what was going to happen, he started running back because there was just this mob of people heading towards him. But he had a fan club there, Cigar Mile Day. People told me they drove from Michigan. The lady drove from Wisconsin. There was a whole group there. Yeah, that means a lot. And my wife and I got a ton of fan mail. I mean, you wouldn't know, you can't imagine. I got 2-page letters, you know, that will make you cry. We got dozens and dozens and dozens of roses. A guy sent me $10. Please buy Max carrots. Cool. You know, we got boxes with carrots and peppermints in them. I got wristbands that say Maxim Security on them. Somebody had them made. I mean, it was just, and I'm still getting stuff. I got a tie the other day. A lady painted that said Maxim Security on it with his picture. That helped. That helped a lot. It was all good stuff.
I'm not going to lie. It was a very special day. And I must say, I'm one of the fan club as well. I'm a very big fan of him. And that race and the ease which he dominated it. And then, obviously, now going back to the Cigar Mile only a week ago, how much did that gold ruler win give you confidence going into the Cigar Mile?
Well, I'm superstitious, you know, and I'm not going to tell you this horse is doing super. When the press calls me, you know, I get this feeling. The first thing they say is, how's your horse doing? And you're going to say, oh, he's doing great. Well, I'm not one of those guys. But we really felt good after I got that race under his belt at Belmont. You know, I had a barn there. We had took him over and breezed him over the track in the paddock, which is really kind of uncharacteristic for me. I was feeling really good about it. You know, because I know how it is with luck and racing gods, and, you know, they knock you down quick. And I don't care how much you like your horse, but in the paddock, he was just being so good and spot on. And I said to Henry, man, he might just run the best race of his life. And that's exactly what he did.
Horse makers look very good, but also they're very humbling in the way that they can indeed, like you mentioned, you might think you have a certainty, but anything can happen in racing. But he came back showing the United States, showing everyone that he was, in my opinion, the top 3-year-old this year. And I'm hoping, and I'm hoping for you and for your team, that this will have secured the Eclipse Award as champion 3-year-old male for him. Are you keeping your fingers crossed?
Yes, like I said, I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, I like to say too, you know, the West are very patient. It's always about the horse. I never had any pressure. There's a race here. There's a race there. Could have went to the Travers. We could have tried to make the Breeders' Cup. I didn't feel it was the right thing to do by Max. And they were 100% on board. Whatever you think is best for the horse. You know, it all fell into place and actually worked out great.
The Eclipse Awards are hosted at Gulfstream Park, which is a track that he's 4 from 4 on the 23rd of January. And amid 2 days later will be the running of the Pegasus World Cup. How are you feeling about that race to mark his 4-year-old debut?
Sure, it's on the table. Absolutely. Pegasus is on the table. You know, I could give you 20 million reasons why to go to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, but I got to, you know, nothing's engraved in stone yet. You know, that race in Saudi's 20 million, the race in Dubai. I would think if you went to Saudi, you would stay and then go to Dubai. Getting feedback that the Pegasus purse was cut to $3 million from $9 million. Everything's still up in the air.
That's mostly the case with horses indeed. But going into his 4-year-old season, do you think that we might have not even seen the best of him yet?
I got to tell you, I think some of him, we had a breeze over Aqueduct. He had a race under his belt with the bull ruler, but it's also, he got a 3-month. He was more mature. He's a late foal. I'm not going to put the whammy on myself and tell you he's going to be better next year, but he's only 3.5 years old technically. So, you know, hopefully as he gets older, he'll get better.
I certainly hope that we haven't seen the best of him yet, because he has been, in my book, and I'd say a lot of people would agree with me, the star of the 2019 racing season in the USA. And Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with us and sharing your story. It's been incredibly informative, and I very much enjoyed hearing more about your background as well as Maximum Security.
Thanks a lot, Naomi. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Naomi. Indeed, very insightful, interesting chat. Thank you, Jason Service, as well. That was a great visit. Thanks also go to Jonathan Kinchin and our sponsors, including Stats Racelens, Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and 10 Strike Racing, among them. Black Type Thoroughbreds, we'll throw them in too. Been so much fun working with Jake this year as well. But most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. Keep the comments rolling in. We'll get to more hashtag AskITM questions as well. Best way to reach out if you don't have my email already is through the InTheMoneyPodcast.com contact page. This show's been a production of In The Money Media. In The Money Media's business manager is the recently returned Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. Hey, everybody, just wanted to give a word for our latest partner, Stats Racelens. This is a product that is definitely worth checking out. You can even get discounts if you use the promo code STATSITM. We're talking about customizable PPs with comprehensive research abilities, video replays, advanced search and notifications, access to stats true odds, handicapping angles, and back testing. That's what Scott Coles used to help him win the NHC this year, and he's talked about on this show. It's mobile and tablet friendly. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. And make sure you use the promo code STATSITM. STATSITM.